Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love with you. You be brave, your lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance.
Jericho Braun with us, the author of Fresh Start, a hands-on business guide for reinvention. And I love the word reinvention. He's been a successful business leader for 25 years now, holding senior management positions at ARCO, Heinz, and Federated Department Stores. He's the author of Fresh Start, a hands-on business guide for reinvention. And let's say, Jerry, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. By the way, though, reinvention, I think that's the operative word. Jerry, there are too many people that are stuck in the positions they are, and it's such a highly competitive market out there. Most people have no idea that they can reinvent themselves right where they're at and just soar. What gave you the idea that this could be the innovator for most people in business now?
Because, Michael, I was there. I was stuck, going nowhere, working long hours, 12, 18-hour days, and getting nowhere, just working harder and getting more work as a result. And so what I did is I invented a little process which allowed me to re-engage my employees, which made my life easier.
Now, by the way, most people go to work and there's really not that incentive. Jerry, we go all the way back, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Employees were employees, and it was Bob and Janet and Bill and Michael and everybody else. But it seems as though what it's come to is associate number 437-6. There seems to be no incentive, no reason that people enjoy going to work anymore.
I know. Isn't that something? You've had businesses. You've come across this
sure.
many times in your life. You have employees that are basically just showing up for work. They aren't engaged with the company's success because basically they feel, according to Victor Vroom, a Yale professor, he basically came up with the expectancy theory. And this theory said if the employee perceives in this company that whatever they're going to do at it work, if it isn't going to lead to a better job performance or more money, they probably are not going to be motivated to help out. So across the country, you've got 67% of the employees, by survey after survey, say that they aren't motivated to help the company succeed. And then the people that are management are stuck with the fact that their employees are working at half speed, which makes their life hard, to put it mildly.
Now, one of the things that
one
of the things I've noticed in business today, that everybody's out there in this competitive marketplace, and the one thing that they're missing is the internal core business that they have, the things that the blind spots that they're not seeing that's within their own businesses. And most of it is the development of their own employees to be able to get those people to feel like they're vested in the business. Maybe not the, you know, financially vested in the business, an equity ownership, but there's another kind of an ownership you can have in a business that makes them part of it. So if the business succeeds, that's them too.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, survey after survey has confirmed that people just don't feel part of the organization, and it's because of a number of hidden biases within the organization. Now, the average person cannot change those biases. They exist. But the problem is, how do you re-engage those employees? One of the problems with employees is they do not have enough say-so in how their jobs are done. Management makes 80% of the decisions for them. They just follow it, and they don't feel part of it. Now, if you can flip that model around, and for those tasks that they are doing, if you can flip the decision-making around and give the employees 80% of the decision-making, with the managers holding 20% of the bigger items, then they feel they have ownership. So ownership is key, to get them engaged in the business and helping the company succeed. Because there's a lot of untapped potential out there that employers across the nation are just missing out on.
And by the way,
Fresh Start is a...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, when we're dealing with managers, for the most part, managers don't know how to manage in this world today. And I think just the title in and of itself, you know that old thing, Jerry, about the Peter Principle. You get somebody who is a great salesperson, and they're there long enough, they get boosted up and they become a manager, and they're an okay manager and a great salesperson. Then they get kicked up the ladder again because they've been there, and they're a lousy executive, an okay manager, and a great salesperson, and they've hit that height of incompetency. They're good people, but they're beyond the pay grade.
Michael, that happened to me. That was my first job. I was way over my head. I was technically good, very good at what I did. I got promoted, and I didn't know how to manage. I reverted back to form. I did the things that I was comfortable with, doing the detail work. And it's hard for people to step away and do what's needed for their new position. And Fresh Start is a way to acknowledge that and a way to get you reengaged into the tasks that you should be focusing on, not on the stuff you used to do. Because as you move up, your role, responsibilities, and duties change, and you have to change with it, and a lot of people cannot make that transition.
Frightened to death of something different.
They want to go and be back on the line deciding how everything is done, and it's frustrating for the employee. And it is not good for the company.
There's that old adage, better unhappy than unsure. And I think that's really what we're dealing
with. Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah, and it's building them to a point where the unknown becomes a known.
Yes. Yes, everyone's change resistant because they know the devil they have, and they're afraid of the devil they don't have. But if all managers begin to think of themselves not as a manager, but the president of the department, they will have a different view of things. So if they take ownership and become the president and delegate more of the actions and the decisions down through their organization, you will have a higher degree of success of reengaging those employees, getting them motivated so they feel ownership and begin to paying attention to what's going on. For instance, they may stay an extra hour. Maybe they make a couple phone calls that'll make a difference in the sales. Maybe they get a report out. Maybe they do something. I estimate that 67% of employees aren't motivated, and that's costing the average company 18% leakage of profits or costs because the employees are there, but they aren't working.
Jerry, you know what I found over the years, and I think this is very interesting, and it is probably transcend through most businesses. You walk into the CEO, CFO, whatever the case may be, COO, and you get their subordinate, whatever manager there is, and you say to that CEO, write down what your manager's job is. And the CEO writes the manager's job down. Then you go to the manager, and you say to the manager, write down what you think your job is and what you think the CEO thinks you should be doing, you know, the difference between the two. And you're always going to find a lack of communication because what the CEO writes down that the manager should be doing, the manager is writing down something completely different. And I think that trickles all the way down, which obviously affects the bottom line. One of the biggest problems I would experience that management has is the manager does not know what their job is because it is not well defined.
I've seen that over and over also. And in fact, Fresh Start tackles some of those issues and has a suggestion on how to basically build in a process that will enable that clarification of roles and responsibility, not only for the manager, but for the employees. It's a way of everyone to re-examine their role in the organization and how they fit in the organization. Too often an employee doesn't feel that their particular tasks are important. But if you can lay out to them why what they're doing, why they're hired, what their role is, and why it's important to this organization, then they feel more special.
Yeah.
They feel like their work has meaning. Everybody wants to have meaningful work. And it's a matter of just formalizing it and verbalizing it, which gives them more ownership. I'm important because. And that is one way, one technique to reengage employees and get them working on behalf of the company, not grumbling about the situation.
Jerry, as simple as that is, I can repeat it, as simple as that is, that's the core, the main crux of most of the problems that's inherent in business. I mean, you know, you hit it spot on.
I couldn't agree more, Michael. You hit it. You've had businesses. You've seen it. And is how do you reach those people? Because it's important. And management have to make that effort because the employee is not going to do it. You have certain employees that are self-motivated and they don't need any help. But the vast majority are waiting for management to tell them and reach out to them and make them feel part of the organization. And what we typically do with behaviors, if we have employees that are behaving bad and the manager doesn't tackle those issues, the rest of the employees suffer because they have to work around this individual. So
Jerry,
management has to say, you're important, and that behavior that you're doing right now, whether it's engaging or not engaging in a company or causing problems internally, it's causing unnecessary stress in everyone's work environment. And managers frequently, if that's a high-performing person, ignore that behavior.
Well, let me give you an example, Jerry, of bringing it together where people feel vested. 20, 25 years ago, I was doing some consulting for a medical firm, and actually it was a dental office, and their bottom line was okay. I mean, the guy was making money, but he wanted to really move it. He wanted to get the employees. You know, it was that typical, you know, one department didn't like the other department, and somebody was talking about somebody else. So I was running a meeting one morning, and I walked in and I said, okay, and I had talked to the dentist beforehand, and I walked in and I said, okay, this is the last, you've seen the last raise anybody in here is ever going to get. And the mouths dropped open and the eyes glazed. And I said, here's how we're going to do it from now on. Every time that you refer somebody into the office, there's going to be a commission in it. And what we're going to do from department to department, what we're going to do is at the end of the month, we are going to put all the commissions together, and then we're going to equally split them with everybody. You want to make more money? Bring people in. I'll tell you what, they were jammed in the bottom line, skyrocketed, because now everybody had a vested interest in the company.
Yes. That's a great example of how small modifications can make a huge difference to employees' attitudes and behaviors, which translate into a stronger bottom line for the company.
No question. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at where we can buy the book and find out more about what you're doing?
Yes, there is. Cole Braun Associates.com. That's all one word. ColeBraunAssociates.com. The book is Fresh Start, and it's a way to reengage your employee workforce at a departmental level. It's targeted for the department manager. It's for those that are running parts of the company, but not the full company.
Wonderful. Hey, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you for having me.
And in today's marketplace, what you have needs to be out there in businesses.
Well, thank you.
Take care. Good night.
It works. Okay, good night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Brenda Burchard with us. He's the author of The Millionaire Messenger, Make a Difference, and A Fortune Sharing Your Advice. He's the founder of Experts Academy and the best-selling author of Life's Golden Ticket. He's one of the top business and motivational trainers in the world, an influential multimillionaire himself. He inspires over 2 million people a year with his books, newsletters, products, and appearances. And let us say, Brendan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the millionaire messenger, I guess within all of us somewhere, there's a message. And maybe if we don't know to look for it, we don't find it. And if you can't find it, you can't share it.
That's right. Well, I think we all have a message that we want to share with the world in some way or another. And I suppose my argument is simply that we've all had a lot of knowledge and experience that and wisdom that we've learned over our lifetimes. Why not take that knowledge, experience, and wisdom and define it and share it with other people so that we can have a career sharing advice?
Okay. Now, by the way, in the sharing of advice, you'd have a collection of people that wouldn't be, you'd have to come out of, let's say, one base location where collaboratively you put this advice together, and if you add enough of it together, through attrition, you get these things that come out of it that you would have never had before. Synergism, that's the word I was looking for.
Well, sure, you could have that, or you just go it alone. I mean, I think we all have a message that, you know, that doesn't mean that we always need to amplify or synergize with other people. The reality is a lot of experts in the expert industry end up being solopreneurs. You know, they're just finally deciding to take what they have had and they're synthesizing their life experience in such a way that now they have found their message and they can help that message get out in the world.
Where did this begin for you? Where was that point in your life where there's this bright spot that you said, oh, this is important, and it came to fruition for you?
You know, I was blessed to have an accident, actually. When I was a young man, 19 years old, I had a car accident. And it taught me that, you know, at the end of our lives, we're all going to ask the same basic questions. We're going to wonder, did I live? You know, did I live fully and openly and honestly? And did I love? And did I matter? And I had to face those questions myself as I faced my own death for the first time as a young guy. And I got to realize that if those are the questions we're going to ask at the end of our lives, well then, gosh, why don't we live our lives so we're happy with the answers at the end? And the experience was so dramatic for me and inspired so much of me. I just thought, gosh, maybe it's part of my life's purpose to share this experience with other people. Maybe I'm supposed to talk to people about the end of our lives and help them begin second chances. And maybe I'm just supposed to tell people about the experience, and it could inspire some people, because my friends and family would say, oh my gosh, you got to tell people about this experience you've had. And of course, many people listening right now have had that same thing. People say, boy, you got to tell people about that experience. You've got to share the message. But I, like many people too, I never knew how. And then I slowly discovered the expert industry, where people would get their message out there through books and speeches and seminars and coaching and websites and consulting, and learned that people were actually not only living a life of purpose by sharing what they knew, but they were also profiting from it and being able to have a great lifestyle as a career in the expert space.
And so many people are frightened to death to be able to say, I can do this, I can talk, I can be whatever. Brendan, I think somebody said, years ago, I was doing an interview, and which made all the sense in the world. They said if you project 10, 15, 20, 25 years ahead, and there was a party they were having for you, they were honoring you in that party, and you'd write down what you'd want them to say about you. Now you got 15, 20, 25 years to create that person that you want to be. And I think that most people, if they will just open up and just do it, their lives would be completely different. They're frightened to death. There's a fear in there, and the fear of exposure. And the idea is that the things that they're hiding are the very things that make them special and that could help people, other people in the world.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Most people are fearing and living their life on some kind of fear of rejection. And unfortunately, they just never studied math that well, and that rejection actually doesn't happen that often. You know, you've probably met thousands of people in your lifetime, and most of them thought you were okay, let you in about your life, didn't judge you, and weren't mean to you or harshly rejecting you in a way that actually forever, you know, made an indelible impact on your identity and that it hurt so bad. The reality is that probably only happened, what, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. I've asked audiences around the world, usually it's somewhere in the average of 5 to 7 times if they're adults over 40 years old. So they've been rejected 5 to 7 times in a way that significantly hurt their feelings and shaped their identity. Yet they met thousands of people. So 5 times out of thousands of times they've been rejected, and yet that's their number one fear, something that barely ever even happens in their lives. I think we all got to get over our fear of rejections and find a higher calling and a higher purpose to put our message out there.
There's a line in a book that I will never forget. I did the interview, I don't know how long ago. It was a fellow by the name of Mark Nepo, and the book was The Book of Awakening. And it's basically said having the life that you want, being present in the life that you have. And there was just a small sentence out of there, and it said it all. It said, living over hiding, being over thinking, participating over observing, and thriving over surviving. That's what happens when people step out. Most people won't step.
I agree. And I think what happens is most people do step. It's that they don't step again and again and again and again. I think everybody has a taste of exactly what he's talking about. Everybody has a taste of that time in their life when they're vibrant and contributing and creating and feeling connected to themselves and their overall message and humanity. It's just that we back away, that we stop advancing, that we stop stepping because we get hurt or we get scared or the unknown is just too overwhelming. And at some point, those who do find something more magical in their lives are those ones who take the step after the step after the step.
Well, and I believe in today's world, especially in today's world, the culture that we live in today, which is very confusing to most people because it's not a tangible definition, the economic conditions that we're in, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. There are people that are frightened to death, and I believe that the message that you are talking about, that is going to be the difference between survival and not survival. It's we've stopped believing in ourselves, and that really is one of the main thrusts that causes us to move and be who we are. And when you stop doing that, if you stop stepping outside yourself and thinking thoughts that you didn't think you could think, quote unquote, then what's the use? What's the sense of even trying to survive?
Right. Yeah, there's a section in The Millionaire Messenger that talks about the different mindsets that you have to become a millionaire in the first place once you've defined your message. And so many people get trapped in this belief that, well, you know, because of my life story or because of the economy or whatever, I don't have this thing or I don't know that thing, so I can't succeed. But the difference between those who succeed and those who fail is that those who succeed, when they say, well, I don't know that or I don't have that, they go out there and they learn it and master it, or they go out there and they build it for themselves. They don't let the reality of what's facing them right now prevent them from becoming who they can become in the future. And they go and they consciously craft their life. They go out there and consciously craft their own circumstances. Not to say that circumstances don't ever jump up and surprise any of us. I mean, we've all had medical issues or challenges or trials and tribulations in our lives. But the triumphant carry on to their own tune. The triumphant choose their own way. And it's those are the ones who succeed because they decide, I will figure this out. I will master this. I will keep at this. I will learn this. I will build this. And so they do.
Now, by the way, and whatever that this is where the problem lies. And when I say the problem isn't in other people. It's within ourselves. We look in the mirror. We're the ones who stop us from doing things. When you were in the accident, when you almost died, that was the best thing. You said it. The best thing that could ever happen to you. These challenges that we get in life, if you truly look at those challenges, they're absolute gifts. That doesn't mean that they're fun to go through at the time. But if you just take a breath and stop resisting it, all of a sudden it looks completely different and you step up on a new plane that would have not been there before.
Agreed. It's like what Viktor Frankl taught us a long time ago, and he wrote a great book called Man's Search for Meaning. He said that, it's not that we lack the means anymore as a society, it's that we lack the meaning. And yeah. So many people have all the resources they need. I mean, that's where the guilt comes in today's modern society. So many people are living in the age of abundance. They do have a car. They do have food. They do have a house. They do have security. They do have safety. The challenge is, despite having all that, they're still guilty and they're upset because they know they're not activating their potential because they're not living the meaningful life they were meant to. And I've been asked my whole life, what makes a meaningful life? And all I can say is that everyone I've ever interviewed, and when I asked them about meaning or contribution or purpose, they always mentioned how giving back was important. And when I asked about giving back specifically, what was meaningful to them in giving back, it was never about giving money. It was giving, usually, mentorship, helping and serving others, guiding them into their own highest potentials. Mentorship is the path to meaning, and mentorship in this economy is also the path to becoming a millionaire. By teaching other people your knowledge and your wisdom, your experience, giving your advice, that's sharing your wisdom. That's mentorship. And by doing that, you build what we call an expert career, by helping with other people with your own how-to advice. And from that, that becomes incredibly profitable, but it also is done with purpose.
No, absolutely. Well, a purpose, I think that's the key word, the big P word here. Because when you're dealing with purpose, most people are totally on purpose, but for the wrong reasons. They ask the right questions, they ask the wrong questions. They get the right questions, right answers for the wrong questions. And they're on purpose, but they're going down a road that's never going to get them anywhere. I really believe when you take a look at something like, the Millionaire Messenger, the Make a Difference in a Fortune Sharing Your Advice, a little bit of shift in your thinking, and then you start asking the right questions, and the right questions get you down a path that's going to get you someplace. And I was talking about responsibility before, a failure before, a rejection, etc. We're responsible for it because most of us fail and we're frightened to death to take a step because of what somebody else is going to think. And who cares what they think? They're going to think what they think no matter what you do. So you might as well step out there anyways, because whatever is going to happen is going to happen.
Yeah, I think our greatest gift is the ability to creatively express ourselves. And when we stop doing that out of fear of others, when we don't express what's in us and what's been given to us, our unique gifts, talents, or strengths, or even just perspectives, then we're cutting off the uniqueness from the world. We're just adding another body. And that's not what we need on the planet. We need unique, diverse perspectives, and that's given to us. Now the choice is whether or not we step up to share it.
Now, by the way, in today's world, we've got so many experts. We've got gurus. We've got this and we've got... How do you filter through? How do you see who's for real and who's not? There's so many people out there that are giving you all of this wonderful stuff, but that's really not wonderful stuff. You got to be able to filter through and see who's genuine out there.
Yeah, I think there's three ways to become an expert. You can either be the results expert because you went out and you got the results and now you're sharing with other people how you did it. You can be the reporter expert, the person who goes out and see how everyone else got the results and shares with others how they did it. Or you can be the role model expert. You're just the role model in terms of who you are, so people listen to your advice because you're authentic and you're trustworthy and you care. Well, I think the best way is to be all three, to get the results, to know what everybody else does so you understand not only your own results, but you understand broader best practices, and then to be just such an exceptionally true, authentic, transparent human being. Well, if you're doing all those, the right people resonate and the right people will become customers. Not everybody in the world resonates with me, and I'm totally cool with that. I don't need the world to approve of who I am to succeed. what I need is the people who resonate with me to believe in it enough and to need my services enough to offer to pay for it. That's how I have the career. And ultimately, it's not about winning everybody. It's about serving as many as you can and letting fate or letting the presence or the power of now or whatever you want to call it take over from there. Because the truth is, once you put it out there, the right people will find it. Just as much as we know, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Absolutely. No question about it. I think one of the examples you've used was Napoleon Hill. Napoleon Hill got everything he possibly wanted out of what he did. Wasn't a wealthy man, but that's not where his head was at. And the lives that that man touched, I remember, you and I will keep this date a secret. Okay. In 1963, I was 21 years old, and I went to work for a life insurance company. And the first thing, the general agent, they hired me, I got my license, and I walked into the office, and my first day on the job, he handed me Think and Grow Rich.
Mm.
Yeah, that was the first
thing. Changed your life.
Pardon me?
It's a book that changed your life.
Absolutely. It's mindset. And I really believe the one thing that has transcended all of the years, I don't care if you're talking 1700 to 2011 or 12, it's mindset. A simple shift in your thinking can change your entire life. One small way to look at something different, and everything's the same out there, yet the outcome is completely different.
Yeah, that's absolutely, and especially today, that's really important for people to hear because, you know, the overall cultural malaise and mindset right now is of you know, fear and backpedaling and thinking small and holding up. And right now, we don't need people to hold up. We need people to step out and become leaders.
Absolutely.
We need voices of inspiration right now, not more voices of critics. We've got plenty of them. We need people to move society. So we can never, you know, let the fact that we're beginning, or as I say in The Millionaire Messenger, you know, never let your small business make you small-minded. You know, we're all beginning somewhere. We're all starting anew. But don't let that choke you from the vision you have for yourselves and the ability to actually move and shape this world, because what we can all accomplish singly and individually and collectively would blow our mind if we'd ever tap into it.
Oh, absolutely. Brendan, we're just about out of time. The website, we can find you in the book and everything you're doing yet.
MillionaireMessenger.com.
Okay. And by the way, I've really appreciated you being here tonight, and that 1962 stuff, we'll keep that as a secret.
I won't tell a soul, I promise.
Wonderful. Okay. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for helping share my message, and I hope everyone else goes out and shares their own just like you are. Thanks for what you do.
Take care. Good night.
Bye now.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought. There we go. Thought-provoking music on Dresser After Dark.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Mark Brenner and C. Sewell with us. They are they've co-founded the One World Institute and co-authored The Science of Activating Your Supreme Power. With English as his fourth language, Mark's lived across the globe and holds an MBA from Israel. Cease has graduated from summa cum laude from Fordham University. She's now working towards a doctorate in psychology in the United States. The couple, recognized as America's and Europe's leading experts on creative thinking, advanced trend spotting, mental strength, and perceptual power, having been featured on ABC, New York Times, the New York Observer, Fortune, CNN Money, and other American and European media, as well as Asian print, this couple shares from years of personal experience, their proven track record of success, and years of acquired knowledge. Cease and Mark, hi, welcome to the show. Do we have you?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. There you are. Hi, welcome to the show. Mark, let me start.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you both for being here. Mark, let me start with you. The science of activating your supreme power. What I'm hearing out of that, and stop me if I'm wrong, that we all have this certain special something within us, but we don't know how to activate it. And so many people go through life with it buried.
That is absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just answering for him.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. That is exactly what the book states. We have an innate power. It's inborn. And a lot of us live our lives almost like lions who think that they're fleas. And our book helps everyone realize that, you know, according to this metaphor, they are a lion. You are much more powerful than you may think.
I would say that by conditioning your mind to realize an empowering existential understanding of life, the book, The Science of Activating Your Supreme Power, helps you interpret all, and I repeat, all of your experiences in the most adventurously favorable way.
Now, by the way,
it provides, I would say, a worldview that beneficially guides your focus and perception, which allows you to interpret all challenging situations in a way that serves your highest interest while naturally eliminating stress. The result is you stop selling yourself short in life, love and work, and start activating your power from within.
Now, by the way, Famali, I see here that you both spent a little bit of time in prison. What got you there, and what was the major thing that you learned while you were incarcerated?
Well, as you may know, in 2008, Governor Spitzer resigned for using an escort service. Mark and I own that service. We went to prison, and it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to us. We made some harmful choices, and we made some changes. And instead of being angry or defensive about everything that happened, we accepted full responsibility and made better choices. Now we teach other people to do the same in their relationships, finances, careers. After being imprisoned, we were released, we reunited, and we took one look into each other's eyes, and it was at that key moment, almost a moment lost in time, where we realized that the other person was stronger, not weaker than before, as we might expect. And I think that's when we decided to help people empower themselves. We almost felt that it was our calling.
Exactly.
Now, let me throw this out. Let me tell you what I just heard. That prison in and of itself, symbolic prison, aren't most people in prison? In their own minds, they've got themselves locked up. They won't let themselves out, and they won't let themselves be free. So prison for the two of you is the best thing that ever happened, because it allowed you to see that you've got to be able to move out of this. You have to be able to step into a different life. And I would believe very strongly that most people are in their own mental prison.
I would agree with that. I would also say that, you know, while I was there, I realized one thing, that I had to contribute more to the presence of compassion in this world because there's still not enough of it. But in order to be compassionate, you have to have an inner strength and understanding. You know, personal empowerment is needed before you can be compassionate, which is, you know, now what we help people find within themselves, that empowerment that allows you to be compassionate.
On my part, I would say that I learned that all pain and suffering is a result of our perception, being in the box. With an empowering perspective, pain and suffering, I would say almost magically, disappear. They are replaced with constructive thought and action. That's what happened to us. So being regret because we've been in prison, it would be not true. We discover so many things, we experience so many things, it made us even much better than ever before. In our case, I'm not promoting prison, God forbid.
No, we don't want to do it. But when we truly look at it, there's so many people running around this world with this stress. When you really deal with it, can't you just convert it to become something that's going to work for you? It's like an alcoholic. Somebody who's an alcoholic, they're an addict. They are addicted. They never become a they're always recovering alcoholics. They're always going to be an alcoholic. But what would happen if you just took that addiction and you moved it in a different area? You took the stress and you redirected the stress. All of a sudden, the world is different, and you're using what's been going on, what's caused you to slow down.
I think that most people are selling themselves way too short in their current lives. You know, some people are at dead-end jobs. They're not making as much money as they should. And even if they're making a lot of money, they're not making as much as they could. Often when people are making a ton of money, they're miserable with other aspects of their lives. And these and similar problems result from not having, I would say, an empowering perspective. I mean, someone's perspective determines everything in their life, from their bank account balance to the happiness that a person experiences day in and day out. To give another example, you have people who are in relationships or friendships, and they feel that these relationships are dragging them down emotionally and mentally. They don't know how to fix these relationships. And many times they're wondering if they should bail completely. With an empowering mindset, these sorts of real and very painful feelings, as being at a dead-end job, having money stressors, having painfully draining relationships, these can all be turned around into blissfully happy circumstances, fulfilling careers, large wealth, with minimal effort, when you have an empowering mindset.
When it comes to the nail-biting
anxiety, the heart-racing stress, or just that mundane sense of feeling down day in and day out, there's only one thing that will catapult you toward happiness and strength. You need an empowering perspective. You need to activate your inner power.
Yeah, and by the way, Michael, you were absolutely right when you said that depression or misery is basically addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, when we really come down to it, and I think most people are frightened to death to feel good, because if you go out and feel good, somebody that you're around that doesn't feel good, you don't want to do anything better than they do. So we really get so concerned about everybody else, and the word compassion is a very interesting word. It's got two sides of the definition. One is the compassion to be and feel with people. The other side of that is we don't want to hurt anybody, so we're going to stay stuck in the same place. And it's time that most of us got out of that. I can never be the second best or the first best you. I can only be the first best me. And my best at my absolute best. Mark, I can never be better at being you than you are. And that's the problem that most people have. We try to be the first best somebody else.
Right.
You're right. Wow. It was good.
Right. And I would say that a lot of people, you know, they're just very stressed out, and it's perfectly normal. You know, two-thirds of Americans are actively seeking help for stress. And their greatest source of stress is often work or money, though the stress from work and money then interferes with personal happiness and with their relationships. You know, at our website, activatemypower.com, we explain that all...
Activate my power or your power?
Activatemypower.com.
Okay.
We explain that all stress is just a result of perception or the way that we're interpreting events. You'll notice that the same conditions can be perceived as stressful at one moment and neutral or even easily enjoyable at other times for the same person. You know, the differences in perception are caused by differences in interpretations. And your focus and perception determines your interpretation. But where does this powerful interpretation that can change everything come from? How can you build it and guarantee that it always works? The answer is that a powerful perspective or mindset can only come from realizing the source, purpose, and goal of our existence, in this, that this world is orderly and lawfully organized. By conditioning your mind to realize an empowering existential understanding of life, our book, The Science of Activating Your Supreme Power, helps you interpret all of your experiences in the most advantageously favorable ways.
Now, Cease, let me hold you. Let me hold you up. Okay. I'm a stressful kind of guy. I'm creating a hypothetical here. I'm a stressful kind of guy. What can you do to help me? I'm coming in. I need help through the book, through the workshop, through the classes. What are some of the practical things I can do to bring me to that point of, quote unquote, a better life?
That's like Bill. I had this friend, Bill, you know, someone I went to school with. He had a great job 6 years ago. He has a beautiful wife, two great kids. He gets up every morning, goes to work, and he happens to be very well off. You know, to many people, his life looks perfect. But for a while, he was not happy. He was always stressed out, whether it was because of work or his wife. He felt that he was maybe never there enough for his kids. I mean, you know, he always found a reason. So one day we told him, Bill, you're selling yourself short. You're interpreting anything and everything in a way that is guaranteed to make you stressed out and miserable. You're almost behaving like a chicken with your head cut off. You're being reactive, not proactive. You're problem-oriented, not solution-oriented. You know, and he was listening. And we said, it seems that, like so many people out there, you're reacting to the effects of your life without giving thought to the real causes and meaning behind your stress. And we went on to explain that he should understand that as science shows, we're all living in a well-organized and law-driven world. Your life has meaning and purpose, even though you might not understand and know all of the laws and who really does. Each and every small or big challenge that you have in life is a catalyst for growth and development. You know, the purpose and goal of this life is to help us utilize our human abilities so we can evolve and grow toward higher order, higher complexity, and higher harmony. Without challenges, problems, and pain to overcome, there would be no progress. And whatever or whoever does not progress is stagnant. And in our ever-progressing life, whatever is stagnant is dead. It's not alive. He listened to me, and long story short, Bill read our book, he listened to our audio program, and he realizes his inner power. He activates his inner power more and more each day. Suffice to say, last time we spoke, he was not stressed out. He felt in full control, and he was excited about his newly rekindled relationship with his wife and children. They were going on a tour through Europe, I think. So, Bill, I would say that you have to find the lion in you. You have to awaken your power.
And I would just add again, right, the most practical tool to see all challenges as opportunity for growth. If you be able to interpret it this way, and in our book, The Science of Activating Your Supreme Power, we teach how to do it. You can overcome any challenges, be happy, rich, and whatever you like in your life.
But we're starting to run out of time, but let me give you a prime example of when somebody's challenged and things look really bad. If they work their way through it, what can happen? I know a woman who was a great college athlete, and she had a coach that was working with her, and he did everything he could do. And one day he sat her down and he said, "You're not good enough. You're not going to be a professional, and I don't want to waste my time." And this is the kind of woman you don't say no to. So she went out and she found another coach. And that other coach worked with her, and she became a professional athlete. She also went on to become a professor at a university teaching athletics. Now, let's go back. Mm-hmm. This is what happened because she was told no. The coach that she found that trained her to be the professional athlete, she married the guy.
and what a beautiful story.
Oh, God.
And if the original coach, yeah, if he hadn't have said no to her, she would have never found the man that she's been with for years. All right, guys, we're just about out of time. Please, website we can find you in the book at.
Oh, yes. Tell you guys, you can go to activatemypower.com, and the first 100 people to get the book will receive 3 free videos. If you want that special promotion, you can go to activatemypower.com/dresserafterdark.html. You'll find the book. You can check out the website.
Wonderful. Hey, Cece and Mark, we've got to go, but I want to thank you both so much for being here. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you
And
so much.
Michael, you're welcome. Each time you have or your listeners have any problems, give us a call.
Done deal. Okay, and we'll remember that.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And I promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back with us, Susan Marshall, President of Executive Advisors, LLC, and the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And she's the creator of the Backbone Institute. Susan, hi. Welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray. How have you been?
Well, I don't know. I have to write this down.
Please do. Please do. Gosh, it's been just so, so interesting the couple of weeks that I've missed being on the show. And as you know, we are busily putting together the Backbone Institute and
yes,
having all kinds of interesting conversations and just learning by leaps and bounds. But what I find so incredibly interesting is a little simple tool that I've been using in my MBA leadership class, and then actually I've been using myself personally for, let's see, my oldest daughter's 35, so 30 years.
You were what, six? You were what, six yeah. when you had her?
Uh-huh, yeah. I was a child prodigy.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a whole other show.
That's a whole other show.
The Homely Little Journal.
Yeah.
And as you know, the elements of the Backbone Institute that we're working on are competence, confidence, and risk-taking. And what I've learned, and I continue to be hearing from people and having this reinforced by people who take note of this little simple tool, is that a journal is an incredible tool to build a person's confidence.
Well, I mean, when you're journaling, no, but Susan, just for a second, when you journal, when you write things down, usually when you do something like that, things come up that you may not have thought of or you wouldn't have said. And then
correct.
All of a sudden, it's right in front of you, and guess what? You did it, which is great.
Yes. Well, and it's so interesting. People say, you know what? I don't have time to keep a diary. So before I respond to that, let's think about when you pay attention to stuff and you write it down and you capture information, you can actually figure out how to deal with virtually any human being on the planet. Anybody. I don't care who it is. You can figure out how to deal with them. Happy, sad, you know, crazy person, whatever. You can find opportunities that other people absolutely miss because they're going Mach 2 with their hair on fire. No time to slow down and record anything. No time to think, right? Boost your confidence. I talked about that. And the other interesting thing to me is when people go looking for advice, if they have a record of what they've been thinking about, things they've been noticing, things they've been hearing, they become their own best counselor. Let me go back to my journal. What was I thinking about 3 months ago? What did I hear 4 months ago? What did I notice last week? It's an amazing, well, Jeff Immelt is the, you know, we all know, current CEO of GE. But one of the things that he talked about years ago when he first took over from Jack Welch was that leadership is an intense journey into the self. And I'm beginning to believe that all of the work that we're doing in confidence under the Backbone Guide in the umbrella is really teaching people how to listen to, learn from, watch themselves. Because then they can do whatever it is they want to do if they then start looking at context. So a journal is just a wonderful way to get really, really smart about yourself, about your surroundings, about other people. And it's not just a New Age diary. People, I don't have time to keep a diary. Well, do you like to draw? Do you like to take pictures? Right? Can you capture ideas some other way? It's really how can you use a journal to compile evidence? Evidence? What are you talking about, evidence? And I would argue, and I would love your perspective on this, I would argue that whether we realize it or not, we're creating evidence every single day about ourselves.
Yeah, well instead of evidence, let's say the words, we're justifying that we are who we are. And what we are really doing is we're saying that if nobody else is going to do it, we're saying, this is you. This is how you are. This is how you think. And if nobody else in the world is listening to you, you are.
Right. Right. And when I say we compile evidence, we stumble through some things, right, sometimes that we don't do very well, and then our self-talk is, oh, geez, you're an idiot. You didn't do that. Well, what were you thinking? Or, you know what, I wish you would have waited 10 seconds, because had you thought about it a little bit longer, you would have said X instead of Y. And we have that self-talk running all of the time. And that's where I say we're compiling evidence. And we're telling ourselves through all of these little snippets of information that we're not as good as we think we should be. Maybe we're not as good as other people around us are. Maybe we're figuring out, if we happen to do something really, really well, we surprise ourselves. We say, hey, you know what, maybe I've got some talent here. Maybe we figure out, if we're paying attention, that we're capable of doing a lot of stuff and even doing it better. And if we purposely compile this evidence incidents, things we think about. I believe that we can create a self-portrait, to your point, that is much, much more robust than what we think of ourselves on any given day, at any given moment.
Yeah, also, it's the word justify was what I was looking for. It was also justifying your own existence, the good, the bad, the ugly, whatever the case may be. If you don't look at it, for the most part, you may not see it. It might be a blind spot. And most of us have some blind spots. We don't see it. And there is someone else that can point things out to you. But the problem with that someone else, they're only going to see you through their eyes. So the one that you're going to get the absolute truth from comes out of your own eyes.
And the beauty of it is when we can train ourselves to be keeping track of stuff, however we want to keep track of stuff. We get that feedback from another person, and typically when somebody gives us feedback that's different from how we see ourselves, we don't like it for whatever reason. But if we can capture it and then go back and reflect on it, we can recognize they're telling me about them. They're really not telling me about me. They're telling me about how they perceive me, how they view me, how they experience me. Wouldn't that be wonderful to know?
Yeah, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, well.
I got the one on the other side of the desk going, uh-huh, I'll give you a
hug. Yeah. Here's the information. Let me tell you a thing or two.
Because the world around you is nothing more than a mirror. And everybody should have that on their T-shirt. You are as powerful as you close your eyes. The lights go out all over the world. The secret? You know, the drawing to you. What was that? What do I want to say with the secret? Help. The power of attraction. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's such truth in that. If you look in the mirror and you're sick, guess who called it? If you look in the mirror and you're ugly, guess who called it? If you look in the mirror and you're depressed, guess who called it? Power of attraction. But it can be the total reverse of that, too. You call it, you're going to get it.
Well, and here's where, again, I think the simple, simple tool of keeping a journal makes you aware that you're looking in the mirror and saying, geez, you look terrible. Let me go back and reflect over the last couple of weeks. What have I been noticing? What have I been paying attention to? That gives me some clue as to what my mindset is, as to what I might be putting out there to trigger this law of attraction. People say those words, but most of us, unless we really sit down and start thinking, you know, pretty purposely about it, we don't. It's their words. They pass us by. People move so fast. And they don't understand. I hate when people say that, but it's true. If I were simply to capture the movement and the motion and the emotion of my life, I would have everything I needed to solve any riddle I'm struggling with. When I don't capture it, over time, it becomes unavailable to me because there's too much stuff coming at me every day. And the other wonderful thing about keeping a journal, however you decide, whatever medium you decide it is you begin to pay attention in a different way. That can be very, very exciting when you begin to realize that something you did or did not do had an impact. Wow. People say, wow, well, you know what, I could have mentioned, I taught a class just this afternoon at UW-Whitewater, and the kids were talking about they want to be entrepreneurs, and they want to do this, and they want to do that, but they're terrified of asking a question. And so we explored, you know, well, I don't want to sound stupid, and I don't want people to think that I don't know what they know, and all of the stuff that we tell ourselves. But where we got to was, if I ask a question, I convince myself I'm able to do it, A. B, I get information I didn't have. Maybe it's useful to me, maybe it's not, but I'm smarter.
Do you know whose fault it is that we don't ask questions? I'm going to start it out with politicians, all right? And then I'm going to take you all the way back to when you're a kid, or better yet, your kid walk. I'll do an extreme here, otherwise I'll get thrown in jail. Your kid walks into the room and you say, tell me the truth. And they go, no, tell me the truth. And they tell you the truth and you whack them. Okay.
Yeah.
What is that? Okay. What have we taught them?
And it's Don't tell me the truth or you're going to be whacked.
Absolutely. And if you ask a politician a question, they're not going to give you, they're going to give you what you want to hear. They're not going to tell you the truth because you're going to whack them. You're not going to vote for them. So this is what we've been taught. Don't dare ask a question. Somebody's going to whack you for it. And it's not true.
Thank you. And we are pushing back so very, very hard against those bad behaviors and those bad lessons by saying, you know what? There are different lessons out there. And you don't need somebody else to capture them for you. You can capture them all on your own. And, oh, by the way, nobody even needs to know you're capturing them.
No,
powerful,
absolutely.
Powerful stuff. I think what we need to do is remind people, and the evidence word again, help them build evidence that they have capacity beyond what they might have been told by their teachers or their parents or their ministers or their whatever, people they cared about and maybe told them things that were not true. We don't have to depend on anybody else anymore. Well, we never did, but start paying attention. And so people say, you know, okay, what kinds of things would I, what kinds of stuff would I capture in a journal? And there are four things that I love to suggest because they've been really very powerful in my own word. Capture something you heard, whether it's in a political debate, whether it's in a meeting, somebody said something about a client, whether it's something you overheard about a friend of yours that you didn't know. So capture something you heard. You don't have to judge it. You don't know whether it's going to play an important role in decision-making or your life now or ever. Capture it. Something I heard that I paid attention to. Second thing, something you noticed. This helps people look at the world with the expectation they're going to notice something. It opens us up. It makes us more interested, more engaged. Third one is something you learned. Right, we all have those aha moments. Sometimes we'll sit with the aha and really appreciate it. Sometimes we'll rinse our hair in the shower and the aha moment is done by the time we're done drying off. But if we can capture those things that we learned, again, whether they matter today, next week, 2 months from now, doesn't matter, but they're there. They're accessible to us. And then the last one is something you're currently thinking about. This is probably my favorite. I was talking with a friend, I don't know, 2 weeks or so ago, and she was thinking about pursuing a new relationship. She's in her late 40s. She's divorced. She's been really struggling to get past a relationship. But now she realized when she was, she's actually thinking about pursuing a new relationship. That's a turning point. That's pretty cool. She may look back a month from now and say, geez, well, why was I even bothering about that? But the point is, it's something she registered that had meaning for her.
Sure.
Some people are thinking about a new job. Some people are thinking about moving. Some people are thinking about whether or not to have a family. Some people are thinking about whether or not to leave this jerk of a boss, right? So what are you thinking about right now? And how does that color other things that are happening in your life?
Yeah.
Powerful. You know,
yes, yeah, absolutely. She's over there laughing at me. Susan, tell her to stop it. What do you think of?
Right, she want you to journal now? Michael, start your journal.
I'm journaling.
And let me read it.
You don't want to read it.
No.
It's got to do with whether I should go with ARP or Humana.
Well, what have you heard? What have you noticed? What have you learned? I love that. That's great.
No, but realistically, when it comes down to it, you're right. I was so intent listening to what you were saying because you're totally spot on with it. It's back to recognizing it. If you don't put it down, you won't recognize it. If you don't spend the time to pay attention and ask those certain questions that will zero you right into whatever you want your purpose to be. And most people have no idea what their purpose is.
Well, and let's use a very current example, and I got myself into trouble because I wrote a blog about it, but the you know, Occupy Wall Street protesters. They don't know why they're there.
Wait. Did you like my answer to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a perfect current example, is it not?
Yeah. Why are you here? So, because the government's taking our jobs. Wait, because Wall Street's taking our jobs. Well, if Wall Street give you a job, would you take one? No, because they're taking our jobs. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, I'm embarrassed to see that we have people like that running around that are claiming that they want to run the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've been actually flamed a lot because I wrote an article that said, do you want a waste of human talent? Really, in my mind, I see all of this potential talent, and it's just hanging out, and that saddens me. But, we've got to protest, because if we don't raise our voices, then we're not going to be heard. I don't disagree with any of that. Yes,
true.
Of course we do, but have a purpose.
Yeah, and by the way, I think pooping on a police car is a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
It's just sad. Yeah.
Did you see that?
I did. Now, if that particular individual had kept a journal and, sort of figured out that in advance doing that was going to get a lot of attention, then maybe that was the purpose. But ultimately, it was probably going to prevent a really good job coming his way. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The value judgments don't matter. The capturing life experiences, thoughts as they go through, ideas as you hear them, that's what matters. You can sort it out when you have time to think.
Absolutely. Let me tell you what I will bet, okay? Bet. I would put any amount of money on this. Bet.
Okay.
I heard one of them say that the government should hire everybody. And I would bet that if the government hired the 15 million people out of work, about the third or fourth day of employment, 70% of them wouldn't show up.
Probably right.
Yeah.
But why? Yeah. Why do you think that?
If they wanted to work, they would be working right now. I mean, that's the whole key. Where do these people get off doing? I don't want to get off track here. But where do they get off doing what they're doing, yelling and screaming about they don't have jobs? And it's the people that don't have jobs. And I've seen some supposed to be educated people down there.
Yeah.
They're coming up with some of these extreme answers that I can't believe that they're saying that they would actually allow themselves to be televised and say it. But with that, we're running out of time. Let me do this. Let me ask you, website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com, which is where I have been for many, many years. That soon is to be updated to Backbone Institute. The minute that happens, I'm going to let you know that.
Oh, I love every second of that one. Okay, and by the way, I should have kept you on track. You got me off on the protesters. That could have taken 3 hours. Susan Marshall, thank you so much for being here, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, Michael Ray. It's great to be back.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Damon Vickers with us, the author of The Day After the Dollar Crashes, a survival guide for the rise and fall of the New World Order. He's a money manager. He's a media personality. 25-year track record of articulating investment themes with striking clarity. Listen to those words. And then holding his ground as the daily barrage of market noise forces others to fail. He's been able to spot social trends and use them to play the market with. He's third generation in a financial family. His father was a floor trader for Goldman Sachs on the New York Stock Exchange. Grandfather worked at Kidder Peabody and Company subsequent to his father's career on Wall Street. And they've been at it for a long, long, long time. Damon, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? Awesome.
Oh, good, and I'm glad you are. You know, in a time like this with the economic turndowns, let's call it, and the recession facing us, whether we're in it or not, it's time to feel awesome. I believe in my heart of hearts, and I'm not a financial guy, but there's plenty of money out there. And I think the biggest problem that we have today is the inability to forecast to see if it's going to be safe or not to put that money to work.
Well, I suppose I you know, there are some great ideas out there. There's some great, certainly, public companies. But frankly, I wish there were a lot more ideas for us to invest in. I wish some of these companies that were sitting on the sidelines would be brought public, so that investors could have some, you know, fresh ideas and opportunities to invest in, rather than polishing the pits of Bank America, Citigroup, Intel, Cisco, Microsoft, Texas Instruments, you know, all those types of names that are just, you know, pretty much in a downtrend for the last decade. So there are some great companies out there, and America's still great, too.
I know, by the way, yes, and I believe that to my heart of hearts. I'm an American all the way across the board. The one thing that's very scary to me, you know, and I'm sure you've been watching some of the demonstrations that are going on in Wall Street. These kids that are out there, have you heard some of the responses, some of the answers? One of the reporters will say something to the effect of, well, do you have a job? Well, no, corporations won't let me work. Well, if a corporation offered you a job, would you take it? No, they're the people who destroy jobs. So, you know, you get this going out there, and you have to sit back and scratch your head and say, is this what the future is going to be?
Well, you've got 500 million to maybe 500 to 700 million people globally that are getting out of colleges. They're young. They're very different than our generation, or even the generation that preceded before us, in that I believe the generation that preceded before us, and maybe even the one before that, they really had more trust in the system. They had more trust in the government. They had more trust in the idea of electing a Democrat or a Republican, and they cheerleaded their political party like a city might or a state might cheerlead their own football team. But the younger people of the world are far more connected and far more interested in about a relationship with one another and doing something, I think, a little bit more constructive than the fantasy of the political process, which only seems to serve the special interests. So in spite of the fact that many people think that the gatherings around the world are negative, I think they're actually extremely, extremely positive and good for the process, because discussion of our problems and discussion of our situations is certainly a good first step towards maybe hopefully beginning to find some solutions rather than putting our brains to sleep.
No, by the way, I totally 1,000% agree with you. Damon, I think where we might have a crossroad here is you've got to be, not you in the general sense of the word, you've got to be on the same page, moving in the same direction to get some kind of a connection to have conversation. When you get a group of 1,000 people and you've got probably 600 different reasons that they're there.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It doesn't exist anywhere.
Well, I disagree. Because I don't think we have to agree. I think you and I don't have to agree.
Of course
not. if people get out there and they have a good, honest, earnest discussion and disagree and agree and mix it up, and these people want that and these people want this and these people are are protecting the environment, hey, that's not a terrible thing, and these people are more about maybe a little bit more equality for children or for senior citizens or maybe these people are for something else, we need to be talking about. Maybe there's another group that says, like, hey, the political process is bought and paid for by special interests. This is ridiculous. All of these things are valid things to talk about, and they're not just talking about them here. They're talking about them in all the westernized nations across the planet. This is growing. It's growing from city to city. It's growing from country to country. And what we're moving towards is, and I feel it, as we're moving towards what will likely be the biggest single demonstration that the world has ever seen, and not even a demonstration, like an assembly of people all around the planet It's huge, and it has nothing to do with governments. It has nothing to do with, well, I'm an Iranian. I don't even think it has anything. It doesn't have much to do with religion either. I'm a Catholic versus a Jehovah's Witness versus a Mormon versus a Baptist versus a Buddhist versus that's all of that stuff is irrelevant. I think what it has to come down to inevitably is do we love our children? Do we love our children? Am I willing to extend that love to your child? And am I willing to extend that love to not only my child but maybe the child of an Iranian or a German or a Jew or even an Al-Qaeda child? That really what's at stake is the future of this world and our children. We may bicker back and forth as adults, but look at what's at stake. What's at stake is the whole nut, and it's not looking good. So this is kind of a crying out, if you will, of the problems globally. And thank God we're talking about them. It's a good process.
No, by the way, the process is good. My goodness, you and I couldn't agree any more than that. But in the process, in the strategy, the process, you don't poop on a police car. You don't answer questions that have your answers have absolutely no relevance to anything going on. You don't slop a place up. You don't do drugs.
This is like you got to look at this a little bit. Now, other than you're running a radio show, I don't know you all that much. But I mean, you sound like a guy that might have. I mean, you know about the stuff that happened in the '60s. You know about those demonstrations at the colleges and all this. So I mean, you know about that stuff, right?
I was there.
Yeah, you were there. Okay, all right. So you know, I think pooping on police cars and this type of stuff. I mean, that's kind of a little bit ridiculous. But you know, look, it's variety. The essence of life is variety. It's the beauty of the world in diversity, whether you go into a rainforest and there's every different assortment, hopefully, of butterflies and little mammal creatures and birds and trees and figs. And if you go into the Caribbean, maybe you see mangoes and bananas just out in the jungle. This is the beauty and the variety of our world. So when you tell me there are people there that are quote, defecating on the streets, okay, that's interesting. But there's all kinds of people there. And thank God there's all kinds of people there, and they have all kinds of issues. And what an amazing thing that no matter that they have all different ideas and, quote, agendas and things that they're demonstrating for, they're talking about it, and they're coming together. I think it's tremendously positive.
Yeah,
and, for us to talk about it, this is the political process. People have a right to assemble, and they have a right to thank God they do.
Yes.
Good. This is democracy. You're witnessing democracy is alive. It's good.
Now, by the way, absolutely, yes. But the theme that I've seen so far, I've stayed on this. It's anti-capitalism. It is pro-government. It is saying government owes me a job. Government owes me school. Government owes me this. Yada, yada, yada. And they're talking anti-capitalism. Half of them have no idea what capitalism is about. Yes, there's going to be the Bernie Madoffs, and that's horrible. There is no question about that. But without some of these major corporations, there wouldn't be any jobs. Yes, there are people who take advantage of the system and make money while other people are starving. We also have a president that is out there spending millions of dollars and playing and having a great time and talking about helping the poor. So they're getting mixed messages, and that's causing confusion for them at the same time.
Well, look at. I mean, yes, I don't disagree with that, but you've got. As I said, you've got maybe somewhere between 500 million and 800 million people around the planet of this age group that have graduated from the colleges and the universities. That's a very big block, and they're in the West, and they've been displaced by Vietnam and China and the rest of them, and their discontent and their suffering is growing, and so they're crying out. But it's not just the young people that are crying out. It's the people that are crying about their mortgages and about their finances, and it's people crying out about health care and the fact that they can't afford to. So there are a lot of issues here. Now, the solutions to these issues, by the way, there are solutions. It is these problems are not unsolvable. Health in this country could be easily solved by recognizing that disease, and these are things that we talk about in our book, that disease comes from your nutrition. It comes from the elk that's rotting upstream and that carries into the whole biosystem. We need to pull the rotting elk from the river so that we don't keep having diseased diets and wrecking our aquifers and all that kind of stuff. That's a simple problem. If you've got kids that are or young adults now that can't form sentences and are defecating on police cars, well, that's our failure as parents and as a society, really not.
No, but
let me hold you up. A good educational system.
Damon, the educational system doesn't mean anything. It's your problem, your responsibility. It's my responsibility as a parent with those kids. That's where it starts at home. But they keep yelling, right, education, education, education. If they had all the education in the world, what's that incentive for them to stay in school? Look at the dropout rate. Education isn't where it's at.
But there's a difference. You teach a kid to memorize something, or you teach a kid to love information.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to seek out their own information and educate themselves. That's a much better form of education than the type of educational system born out of the Second World War and creating factory workers and a kind of factorized educational system. A lot of the things that we teach kids are entirely worthless. They have no tangible translation into the real world. And so it's not surprising that we're falling behind. But the problem in the United States and the West is really the inability for us as a country to manufacture a finished good at a price that's globally competitive. That's the simplest as it is that if we're going to manufacture an iPhone, you know, this big, you know, there were, what, 4 million iPhones sold in the last week or something like that. I mean, it's another multi-billion-dollar product launch of Apple Computer. And the thing was manufactured in China. It was designed here, but manufactured in China. And in the past, you know, if we had a technology that would arrive, we would create all these jobs because we would innovate, because we had a society, Michael, that encouraged the crazy person that would defecate on the police car as much as the PhD. And occasionally, you got some creativity out of that diversity. Right, that's our country.
It's a good word. It's a good word. But what's wrong with creating here? What's wrong with the manufacturing plants here? What's wrong with drilling here? We have so much untapped natural resources right now that would put people to work until we moved into whatever alternative energy source that we want.
The planet needs to come into balance with the use of natural resources because we treat the planet like a piece of toilet paper. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, that's the truth.
Okay, but what about the regulations that stop everything? You know, there are ways. Well, let's look at this. Okay, I spent 23 years in Alaska. Wait. And I was up there. I was up there where, you know, where they had the roads that were paved to go up to the oil drilling rigs and so on and so forth. Now, the key here is this. What did they do? They loaded them with ice so they wouldn't destroy the roads. They were very careful with the environment up there. I don't know where a lot of these stories came from, but I physically was up there and saw what was going on. I think the biggest problem is somebody follow the money, Damon, follow the money. Find out where it is that's blocking it and who's getting paid to do it, and I think you'll get a handle on what's going on.
Alaska is not a fair representation of the entire United States. Alaska is one of the last in an area that's in the last frontiers of the world. Alaska, British Columbia, northern Canada, up into the North Pole, and that's a kind of a really the Siberia over in the Russian tundra. That's a beautiful area with a lot of biodiversity and.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Chedd with us. He's the author of Build a Better B2B Business, Winning Leadership for Your Business to Business Community. As a business consultant and a coach, David's advised more than 20 different small businesses to small to middle market clients on such diverse areas as business development, business startup, sales, marketing, mergers and acquisitions, operational improvement, business turnaround, and people development. And again, he is the author of Build a Better Business, a Build Better B2B Business. David, I welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael Ray. It's nice to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, building the business to business, one of the great things that you deal with and is most important to talk about is that word leadership. I would venture to guess that one of the most important things, David, that we could find in the success of any business is to have those people at the top, those people in management, middle management, that are in charge of what the day-to-day operation, if they even know what they're doing today. What makes a leader today?
You know, I think what really makes a leader is taking the accountability and responsibility to make the business successful and to do what's needed to make the business successful. And, you know, so much, I think we see so many of the business leaders today, even like our political leaders, who blame all the other, you know, economics, the political situation and everything for businesses not succeeding. But I think a real leader just stands up and says, all right, the economy may not be great, but we're going to succeed because I'm going to lead us there.
Yeah. No, absolutely no question about it. In all of the work that you've done over the years, has there been an overarching theme, some kind of a commonality that causes business not to make it?
It really comes back to the management, to the leadership. And are they focusing and doing the right things? You know, I've done a number of turnarounds, and what's always surprised me is in every turnaround I've gone in, the people who are working there are working just as hard as any other company that I've been in. And they're just as committed and just as devoted to people. And yet at the same time, the businesses aren't succeeding. And almost always it's because they're just going in the wrong direction, a little bit like chickens with their heads cut off.
Sure.
But passionate chickens at the same time.
Now, by the way, when you're dealing with business, the business has its own inherent problems, obviously, but especially in today's marketplace, David, you've got an unsure economy out there. You have a culture that is not the same culture as it was 30 and 40 years ago. You got people with such diverse and wide different processes for thinking. I think one of the biggest challenges that businesses have today is to bringing it all together under one common movement forward. And that's got to be very tough when you've got employees today.
I think it is, you know, because, again, you might have some of your people have lost their homes. You know, some of their people, you know, they're going through, you know, really bad personal circumstances. And, you know, at the same time, what you have to have is you have to really, I believe, and one of the challenges is to try to create an environment where the people can do as well as they possibly can. And that is if you can get them to be motivated, engaged, you know, and there's a lot of things to do with that. And, you know, I mean, my favorite is just recognition, the simple recognition. You know, I think Michael Bloomberg, our mayor of New York City, he said, you know, in the end, everybody wants recognition and respect.
Sure.
And I think that really sums up pretty well what you can do to try to make as much of a team as you possibly can have in these trying times.
David, I think the big key here is, you know, when you said recognition means acceptance. And what acceptance leads you to is identity. And if you have an identity within the business, if you relate to that business, quote unquote, and you're accepted in that business and you've got the recognition, et cetera, then all of a sudden you're doing something. We search for identity, and in today's challenging times, it's very hard for most people to find that word identity.
I think you're right. I mean, it's the identity, and then right behind that, Michael Ray, is the issue of meaning. Everybody wants to have meaning in their job. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that, you know, we have so many leaders who are not obsessed with, you know, companies like, you know, with Apple doesn't have this issue, because what's Apple, you know, even under, you know, post Steve Jobs, they're really saying, we're going to build the greatest products and we're going to transform the world. That's something you can get an identity. But so many other companies are, you know, the leaders are saying, hey, we need to cut costs and we're going to try to increase earnings per share by 10%.
Yeah.
What identity can we get from that? What
meaning
can we get?
Yeah, zip.
Zip. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm in absolute agreement with what you're saying. But let's do it this way. Let's say I pick up the book, Build a Better B2B Business. I read it page by page, cover to cover. I'm a businessman. I'm a business owner. What do I get, David? What do I get that I didn't have before I picked the book up? Where's it going to take me?
I think what you get is you get an overriding theme is that we make things too complex. Let's get back to the fundamentals. And what are fundamentals in every business? And I think, you know, you've nailed it with that idea of the identity and the meaning. Your team and your employees need to have identity, meaning, feel like they're on what I call a winning team. In addition to that, you know, you just need to focus only on those things that really move the business forward. I mean, we're barraged, constantly barraged with all kinds of things we need to do. But we need to focus out what's not important or what's trivial and focus on what's important. And then the third one is, from any business, the only way any business gets money is by having customers.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to appreciate our customers. And I think we know this from the banks nowadays with the $5 debit card fee or whatever. You know, we've had people, we've been great customers of these banks, and now they're just taking advantage of us. They've taken us for granted. And
sure.
I think what you get out of that is my feeling, and is to just go back and say, wait a minute. Are we taking our customers for granted? Are we easy to do business? Do people actually want to do business with us? Or is it just the torture? And if you can just focus on those three fundamentals of doing the right thing, of what I call winning teamwork and of good customer service, you're going to make your life easier. You're going to realize what's important, and then you're going to get some business success.
I'll give you a couple of great examples of that. I was in the service 150 years ago. And, you know, there was a bunch of guys who were 17 years old when I went through boot camp. And there were guys from all over the country that I didn't know. I mean, I met them. Okay. We became a team. We became a team in such a way that if, you know, thank goodness I was too young for Korea. And by the time Nam came around, I was already in and out. But the point of contention was is that you built a team that you knew that somebody was at your back, somebody was going to protect you. It's the same thing with a football team or a volleyball team. Once that there's a team and everybody's unified, moving in the same direction, and everybody knows that everybody on that team is important than the next guy, all of a sudden you've got the workings of something that's going to be successful, and that's what businesses should be today.
You know, I totally agree. It's funny, in there, one of the things I talk about is motivating and engaging your team in my book, Michael. And in there I say, four of the most useful leadership words are, I've got your back.
Yeah.
And people want to know that, especially when they make mistakes. Because, you know, as we've often seen, and, you know, and I know when you were in the service, people would make mistakes. But nobody wakes up in the morning saying, how can I screw up my business? How can I make a mistake? You know, they're doing their best for it. And yes, they might need some more coaching. They might need to learn some more. You know, or they could be over their head. But they didn't do it on purpose. And, you know, they're responding to what they understand. And if you can be a leader that really supports your people, I've got your back. You've got their back.
Yeah.
It goes a long way to building a team, building the camaraderie that makes a difference. And it makes it much more fun to work at. A place like that.
Oh, sure. By the way, David, you know what it boils down to, and I know what this is going to sound like, but it boils down to everybody strives to be part of a family. And if you can be a family in business, then all of a sudden there is that strength, that there's that interwoven, interlocking loyalty that goes on, and everybody wants everybody else to, you know, move ahead and get better at it. But that's what it boils down to, because it comes down to what you know, where you come from, you know, what you do, where you go. But everybody, I'm going to go back to the acceptance thing, comes back to family. And more businesses today, if they can treat those people in the business as family, with the exception, with the acceptance, with the recognition, with the identity, my goodness, there's no stopping it.
I really agree. I mean, there is no stopping it. And I just don't know why, you know, for me and in my experience in doing it, it was one of the great things to just see the team that I have just blossom and do things that I didn't even know that they could do. You know, they took the initiative and would go off and do those things. And that's the case where, you know, these guys, they just
you know, guys and gals, men and women on the team, they just connected. And they wanted to do it, and they wanted to help one another. They wanted to have each other's back, and and as you say, they moved towards being a family. But you know, so much of it is, it also requires the leader to give up power, in a way, and that's often hard because they're not being the one who's dictating what goes on. And wait a minute, I'm the boss. I'm more powerful. I need to know everything. I need to be over everybody. And there, a lot of people think that way.
Sure. And by the way, this also comes down to people going into business today for themselves. And there's so many people since the outsourcing and the rest of it. You know, we've got entrepreneurs that we didn't have 10, 12, 15 years ago. They got a computer, they got their kitchen table, and they're out there and they're making money. What happens when somebody gets a really good idea and it starts to catch on? They have to augment their skills. They've got to bring more people in because they can't do it by themselves. And I've been a firm believer all of my life in every bit of experience I've had, no matter what it is, that when you bring somebody in, you bring somebody better than you in. But the problem, and we just hit on it a second ago, we've got people who won't allow that to happen. Their egos will not allow them to let somebody come in there who could expand that business, build that bottom line, do whatever the case may be. And I think that's extremely important. And when you do augment, give people responsibility. Let them make decisions in their particular area. My goodness, what a great thing.
Well, I mean, you're paying all the money to bring talented people in. And if you don't give them the responsibility, you know, and give them the authority to go do and be responsible, then in the end of it, what they're going to do is do you remember that old movie, The Stepford Wives?
Oh, yeah,
sure. They did a remake of that where you had these women, you know, the rich guys made these women who were basically empty shells.
Yeah.
In the end of it, you end up with Stepford employees.
Yeah.
If I'm going to tell you everything you need to do, if I'm going to be involved, you know, in many ways, all our smartphones and our internet connection make that, because it makes bad managers be able to micromanage and be there with everybody and you know, take all the responsibility, make all the decision, and really let their people become Stepford people who are just empty shells going through the motion. And as you said, what kind of identity do you get from that? You know, what kind of responsibility?
And David, I think most people don't get it right. You get hired for a job. I don't care if you're on the assembly line in a factory, or you're an accountant, or you're a manager, or you're something. The only reason that you get hired is somehow you're part and part responsible for either maintaining or keeping that bottom line. Period, end. That's the only reason that you get hired. So when people begin to realize that and put themselves in that position to be able to either maintain it or increase it, they're doing the job that they're supposed to do, and if they do it, they do it well, and they're compensated for it, and it doesn't always have to be money, but if they're compensated for it and everybody's on purpose and they know exactly what they're doing, you give businesses the work.
You do, but one of the things related to that, and this has happened a lot today, and I've seen it, and I'll have to admit, in previous lives I've been guilty of this myself, is you have to, in order to get people to take up responsibility, to take on new tasks, you have to let mistakes happen.
Yeah.
And because other than that, what they'll realize is, well, if I keep my head down and don't do anything, I'll be fine. But if I try to do something new and different and make a mistake, I'm going to get my hand chopped off. And then with that, what kind of responsibility do they take? And it's so often, I mean, we've done things where we've made, you know, and I've been made huge mistakes, you know, almost million-dollar mistakes, and I've had other people do that. You know, we've always learned from it, and again, we won so much because that one mistake they made, 10 other times they did something else, they took the initiative, and it just paid off in spades, and
absolutely,
it's tremendous.
Now, you know, and realistically, mistakes are the best thing that can happen to you. If I have to say that 15,000 times a day, I want to continue doing that. A mistake is a great thing. There's no such thing as a failure. If you take a look at what it is that challenged you and move through it, you come out 10 times better. I don't believe in failures. You make a mistake, you make a mistake. How's, you know, it's the old so what.
You know, it's funny, the former founder of the founder of IBM is a guy by the name of Thomas J. Watson, and he had a famous quote, and he said, recently asked if I was going to fire an employee who made a mistake that cost the company $600,000. Now think, this was back in the 30s and 40s, how much $600,000 is worth today. And he replied, no, I replied, I just spent $600,000 in training him.
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you loud and clear. You know, my absolute favorite quote of all the quotes was a quote by John Wayne. And what he said was, life's tough, but it's worse when you're stupid.
I'm going to have to write this one down.
Yeah, because when you really come down to it, it's called, you get knocked out, get back up again. Just do your stuff. And especially in today's world, you're going to have, you're going to have to be tough to make it through it. But if you've got the basics, the fundamentals of when you do fall down, you've got something there to catch you and to move forward, that's what it takes. It takes every mistake that you've ever made, you personally, David, that you put into the book to say, well, okay, this is how to do it so you don't. And why should somebody have to go through everything you went through when they can condense it down to the pages you have and they can anticipate it before it even happens?
I mean, that is. And really, that's really the purpose of my book, is to try to say, okay, here's some good things that I did, and here's some things where I really screwed up. And I mean, boy, I've done a lot. You know, I've wasted money on customer service and new product initiatives. I was slow in a one-time and ethical violation. But what I try to give, and throughout the flavor of the book, is, hey, here's why I screwed up. And when you make mistakes, it isn't an obvious. It's always subtle. You know, I always say it's never black and white. It's always gray. But if you can identify those gray areas and nip the mistakes in the bud, and if maybe some of my examples help you, then I think that it's very valuable to the leader.
Oh, absolutely. No question. We are starting to run out of time now. David, you have a website we can find you, find the book, get more information about what you do.
Yes, it would be www.helpingleaderswin.com.
Wonderful. Hey, David Chen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Have a great
evening. Take care. Good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is
a wrap.
We're parting out as friends, your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do,